From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Later in the broadcast, we'll be joined in studio by Vincent Orange, an at-large member of the D.C. Council. He's running for re-election in the district's primary, which will be held June 14th. Of course, Tom Sherwood is with us. He's our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with the current newspapers. Tom Sherwood.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Also in studio with us, Martin Ostermuhl. He's a producer and reporter for WAMU 88.5. Martin, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Jack Evans barged in today. He's Metro's board chair and a member of the D.C. Council. He's a Democrat representing Ward 2.
Well, I had a pretty open schedule, and you guys called. So
he never left the last time. He's been under the desk the whole time.
Exactly right. You can start calling now if you have comments or questions for Council Member Jack Evans. He's also, of course, the chair of the board of WMATA, 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org or shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show. Martin, yesterday, you can also go to our website, kojoshow.org, and watch the live video stream of this broadcast. Yesterday, Hillary Clinton penned an op-ed. I should mention, Tom Sherwood, that op-ed was in the Washington Informer newspaper. Is that significant?
Well, yes, I tried to call Denise Rollark Barnes to find out how it came about, but Denise won't answer her phone. Maybe she'll call in and tell us.
It's a paper that's published in the Southeast section of the
statement by, she said she would make it part of her agenda if she becomes president. But I would like to know, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Hopefully we'll find out at some point. But that op-ed was in support of D.C. statehood. On the same day, Martin, the House subcommittee with oversight of the district met yesterday for a hearing. This is in response to the district's plan to implement its budget without submitting it to Congress first. What happened at the hearing?
So the hearing was, now, of course, you guys all know what budget autonomy is, but I'm imagining many listeners don't know as well the ins and outs of budget autonomy. Basic point, 1973, when the district got home rule, got an elected mayor and elected council, the one thing it did not get was full authority over its budget. So for the last 40 years, every year they have to submit the budget to Congress. Congress looks at it, potentially changes it, most often doesn't, but then wraps it into the federal budget. And then the money essentially gets reappropriated back to the district when the federal budget passes, if it passes. Now, what the district did in 2013, they had this referendum, which changed the city's charter to basically change the amount of time that Congress has to look at the city's budget. So now Congress, in theory, only has 30 days to look at it, much less time, much less authority to kind of finagle with the city's finances. The city would get the money back and could start their budget year in October on time, which makes running the city easier. Now, this, in theory, was going to take effect this year with the budget that's going to get voted on next week for the first time. But congressional Republicans are none too happy that the district held this referendum. So this hearing was basically a discussion about whether this referendum was legal or not. A Superior Court judge in March said it is. But there's a number of people, including the city's former Attorney General Irv Nathan, who spoke yesterday, who said it isn't. And Mark Meadows, this North Carolina Republican, says he's going to introduce a bill that would essentially nullify the referendum and force the district to go back to the old way of submitting its budget to Congress and then waiting for it to get passed as part of the federal budget. So that's essentially the summary of where we are.
I took the time to look in the Citizen Times out of Asheville, North Carolina, to see what Congressman Mark Meadows had to say about the federal government's mm-hmm. opinion on transgender use of bathrooms in North Carolina. He accused the federal government of trying to bully North Carolina, accused yeah. it of executive overreach, but in his discussion about the district's budget, he used the term that the district would be flouting the supreme authority of the same federal government that he was not denouncing for intruding. But in North Carolina, but I digress.
Yes, sure. But unfortunately, the Constitution says the Congress shall have full legislative authority over the district, so it's not like they're taking a flyer on this, although I do wonder if he took time to go to the bathroom, you know, while he was up on the hill. But here's what this is. The city went forward with the referendum to change its approach, a novel approach to budget autonomy, got it through. They poked the Congress, the Republican Congress, in the eye, and now Congress is about to pay it back by probably, I don't know if they'll do it an independent bill or attach this to some veto-proof bill that will go through the Senate. And the president, of course, will never stand up for the city on this, and we'll lose budget autonomy. Mr. Evans, do you think that's going to happen?
Yeah, that's probably a likely scenario. It's very unfortunate because, as Martin explained, the District of Columbia, it's surprising in this day and age, runs our budget very efficiently. Our finances are the best in the country.
20 years of balanced budgets?
Everything. You know, we are the most fiscally responsible jurisdiction in America, city, county, or state. Federal government is completely the opposite. They're the most irresponsible entity, and they're telling us what to do. And so it makes it, it really just is much easier for us if we have budget autonomy. You know, Congress, particularly those Republican Congress people from I had my own dust up with Mark Meadows. I mean, they're really not educated on the issues. They're listening to staff. They're afraid of losing something they don't really have. So why they're meddling with this is beyond me. But they are, Tom. You're right. And they're going to shut it down. That's
well,
my view.
They're doing everything what they should do, which is get in the Metro and help fund Metro. But we'll get to that.
We'll get to that in a second.
Or really run the federal government correctly. What are they worried about the district budget for? But, my goodness.
What was funny in the hearing was that, you know, Mark Meadows, he invited, he, as the chairman of the subcommittee, has the authority to invite the majority of the witnesses, and he did. One of them, like I mentioned, was Irv Nathan, former D.C. Attorney General. He also had someone who is an attorney who was a staffer at the time that the Home Rule Act was passed, and someone from the General Accountability Office. Now, both Nathan and the person, the staffer who worked on the Home Rule Act, said specifically that in their legal opinion, the referendum was bunk. It was an illegal way to change the Home Rule Charter or get budget autonomy. But they both said, and this was a really important point, that they honestly thought that the principle of budget autonomy held and that this, the district shouldn't have to submit its budget to Congress and that Congress should just act, just pass a bill, give the city budget autonomy, and just move on with their lives.
And Congressman Meadows, on principle, does not like the federal government involved in local and state matters.
That's the point that Eleanor Holmes
Well,
Norton made more than once, of course. So she makes that every time they stick their fingers in our business. But she said, look, you're the best government is local government. Homes, the government closest to home is the best government. And here you are trying to tell us what to do.
Yeah. She also said that the chairman, Meadows, was Congressman Meadows, was planning to go further with legislation that would block any further moves by the district on budget autonomy.
Right. I mean, that's what she's saying. That's what I heard on the Hill yesterday. And so, yeah, I mean, it could basically the point is that if they get around to this, it would nullify the referendum, stop the council from doing anything further on budget autonomy, and essentially leave it only up to Congress. But we can probably safely assume that Republicans will move on this.
How do you politically fight this? I mean, I'm trying not to go on a rant here, but how do you get people of substance? I mean, there must be some wealthy Republicans in town who know these members. I mean, Tom Davis has tried to help.
Jack Kemp is gone now.
Yeah, Jack Kemp is not here, but he's anathema, apparently, to the Republican Party now.
Well, Tom, the ultimate person in charge here is Paul Ryan. And, you know, I, on Metro, I've explained to people, one of the people who I'm trying to meet with and make my case is Paul Ryan. He's in charge, and he could be the person who says to Meadows or every other person, knock it off. And so who knows Paul Ryan? How do you get to Paul Ryan? And that's the big question.
Instead, he apparently...
I think Donald Trump is asking
instead, he's
questions.
Apparently saying the opposite because a spokesperson for the House Speaker said that Meadows had the backing of House leadership and issued a statement indicating...
But again, my point... Kojo is. I doubt that. Yeah, exactly. That Paul Ryan's put a whole lot of thought into this, and if we could convince him of the rightness of our argument, he might say to everybody, "Let's take a walk," because it really doesn't matter. Congress always has ultimate authority. If they think we've gone off the track,
I was talking to Mark Seagraves about this, and a reporter for Channel 4, and he was saying, "Why doesn't the city?" If Congress wants to, why doesn't the city withdraw the services that it does for a lot of things it does, like making an ambulance available at the White House or start enforcing the traffic rules around Capitol Hill? Just start saying, don't treat us, don't bully us. We can, with our limited powers, we can bully back.
Yeah.
And get their attention, because this is a political fight, and you do two things. You're in the suites and in the streets, and the city doesn't do anything to aggressively challenge Congress. Vince Gray did on the shutdown a couple of years ago. It was pretty good. The mayor had said she was going forward with the marijuana initiative. That was pretty good. Nothing happened. But it just seems to me there ought to be a little more toughness from the city.
Yeah.
Politics, toughness.
Yeah.
Look, you said you weren't going to go into a rant. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say the annoyance factor is what you're talking about. You know, can we be more annoying to them and get their attention? And sometimes it works. Sometimes then they respond in their own fashion and being annoying to us. And goes back. I just think rational minds, if the government was working better, frankly, you start with the president. If the president was more involved in the District of Columbia,
well,
maybe
he's
going to
live here after he gets out of the White House. Yeah, maybe he'll get stuck in a traffic jam.
But he hasn't been. I think with Hillary Clinton, who does know the city, who we all know well, if she gets elected president, I'm hoping that she, because Bill Clinton certainly was very involved. Bill Clinton gave us the Wilson Building back. I mean, talk about going into weeds and helping out the city. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a big issue. Hillary hopefully would be as supportive. Donald Trump, I don't know. We've had conversations with him. He's always been supportive, you know. So in the unlikely event he were to win, maybe he could be helpful as well.
Jack Evans is our guest. He's Metro's board chair and a member of the D.C. Council. He's a Democrat representing Ward 2. Sherwood. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter.
Well, did you get the news, Kojo? This is my today is the 25th anniversary of my taking office in the District of Columbia.
This very day.
A quarter of a century of May, representing Ward 2 in the District of Columbia. Jack Evans. If you have questions or comments for him, call us at 800-433-8850. Martin Ostermuhl is also in studio with us. He's a producer and reporter for WAMU 88.5. You can go to kojoshow.org, watch the live video stream of this broadcast. Metro, where shall we start? It's been quite a week. Just last Friday, Metro announced its draft maintenance plan, but officials with the Federal Transit Administration directed Metro to prioritize critical work that they say needs to happen sooner than slated in the plan. What's going on?
Okay, let's start with the fundamental problem of Metro, and I just have to repeat this over and over again. The fundamental problem that will be with us forever is we are a two-track system. It's a flaw in the system. Most other systems are three or four, meaning they can close down an entire track, work on it without disrupting service. We can't and never will be able to. So the challenge is, how do we get track time? How do we get chance to get in there and fix the tracks? And that is the fundamental problem we're dealing with now, is getting time.
Kojo, I want you to address that fundamental problem by way of a question from William in Silver Spring, Maryland. Put on your headphones, please, because William is on the air. Go ahead, please.
How you doing today, Kojo?
Well.
All right. Well, I appreciate everything. And Jack Evans, I appreciate it. And I would hope that the people of D.C. appreciate what you're trying to do for us. But here's my question, and you just answered it to a certain extent. However, what is the difficulty? If we were able to facilitate the construction of the Silver Line, and I understand that was the Virginia project, what prevents us from expanding or enlarging the system to a multi-track system as opposed to a two-track system? What
Jack
are the difficulties?
Yeah, here's the real problem with that. First of all, the cost would be in the billions of dollars, but putting that aside, Metro was built with tubes. There's a tube underground. That's how they constructed this, and then they put the two tracks into the tube that's underground. So there's no more space in the area where the tracks are underground to put another track. And 50 miles of our 117 miles are underground. So you just cannot even correct the problem, even if you had the money to do so.
Okay. On to fixing the problem according to the guidelines by the federal government.
So anyway, we came up with a plan. Paul Wiedefel came up with a plan to go out into the system and fix, in addition to all the maintenance we're consistently doing, fix 15 different areas. The federal government, the FDA, said, we would like you to do these three ahead of the other ones that you're doing. It's part of the 15.
Well, did they say, we like you, or you have to?
Well, they told us we had to.
And they have the authority to make you.
And they have the authority to do so. Yes.
That's why we just turn the whole system over to Secretary Fox.
Let him pay for it. there's some truth to that if they want to do that.
Let them run it.
Yeah. And the discussion the last 2 days was, Paul put forward a plan that made sense, that was well thought out, and then he was directed to change that. And based on what information was he directed to change that? What information did they have that we didn't have that they thought their plan was better than our plan?
Well, he clearly knew that, you know, one track that they're looking to fix is between Van Ness and Friendship Heights, and Van Ness is where WMU is located. So he clearly knew
clearly
that for
knew
us
that
to get
that
to our
was
jobs
the,
and
that
for
was
Kojo
the issue.
Guests to get here.
Right. But
to get here quickly.
He was working on this plan. Why didn't they come to him and that is cooperate as a partner in the Metro system that serves the federal government, instead of these thunderbolts that they throw from on high, the criticism from every member of Congress. I just don't get it. No one's participating. They're all complaining.
You're absolutely right, Tom, and that's my pet peeve. Now, with the FDA and NTSB, they are partners of ours, and communication is the key to better moving forward, and I think we're really working on it. Get me started on the members of Congress. Most of these members of Congress have been here for years. They had oversight over Metro. They did nothing, and now they're all throwing in their 2 cents. One guy the other day said, we're going to hold Metro's feet to the fire. Who's he talking about, me or Paul or the board? There's nobody else.
I read every press
really
release
annoys
from Capitol
me.
Hill. They were all pablum. Oh, you all have got to do better. And apparently they combated. And by the way, asterisks at the bottom of the page, we don't have to do anything but complain.
Yeah. And the second thing is they owe us $300 million a year in operating money. So I would ask the regional congressional delegations, rather than complain, rather than criticize, get it together and get the $300 million. Metro is not going to be able to go forward without it. We are $130 million in the hole going into our FY18 budget. Without the federal money, each jurisdiction is going to have to pony up the one-third of that, and it is really unconscionable the federal government doesn't pay.
In addition to which, there's an $18 billion capital deficit over the next 10 years.
Yes, and let me explain that, because $18 billion is a big number. People don't understand it. How do I get that number? Let's start with train cars. I'll make this real quick. Train cars cost $2 million a car, 12 a month, 144 a year. 10 years, you come up with $2.8 billion in new train cars because we are still running the cars from 1976 that are dangerous and we've been told to stop running them. $3 billion in train cars. We need a new tunnel from Roslyn into the district because we're at capacity. Cost $3 to $5 billion. That's now $8 billion. We need $1 billion a year to do maintenance work, catch-up, and routine maintenance. Yeah. So now we're at $18 billion. So the number makes sense. It's not some abstract number I made up. We have no way of funding any of that. And to add woes to this, we have a $2.5 billion unfunded pension liability. The same number the district had in 1975, and when not treated, sunk the district in 1995.
So,
given their very real safety concerns and all that's been going on, have you received any sign, one small iota of a signal, that the federal government is going to step up its support of Metro?
There are those who speak favorably. Jerry Conley, Eleanor Holmes Norton, mostly the Democrats. The Republicans seem oblivious to this. And, you know, again, going back to Congressman Meadows and Micah and everyone, what I'm saying to them, 50% of the federal workforce gets to work every day on Metro. If Metro stops, half of their staff isn't going to show up. Half of the staff in the federal government isn't going to get to work on time. We are all in this together. We are not Chicago or Philadelphia or some abstract city. We are the nation's capital. We transport the federal workforce. You built two-thirds of the system. So my admonition to them is, please help us.
So one thing I was thinking, on Wednesday I went to the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments where you presented to officials from throughout the region, and you gave what I saw as the doomsday speech. I mean, a lot of what you just said, you really put it in perspective. Look, there's a lot of financial challenges that Metro faces. The federal government has to pony up, but the region also has to pony up.
Yes.
And you said, you know, we need a dedicated funding source, so we have to come up with something. Do you get a sense that by giving this sort of this doomsday type speech, do you think it's getting through to people? Do you think the folks in that room understood the gravity of the situation?
It's very good. And I've given this speech now 4 or 5 times.
Dr. Doom.
The initial reaction to such a catastrophic speech is denial. And you heard it in that room.
Yeah.
Why don't we close the system down? Why don't we, instead of building a tunnel, suspend Metro from the bottom of the Key Bridge? You know, you come up with lame brain ideas that make no sense because you want to deny what needs to be done. Then people start coming around. I want to applaud the head of COG, Roger Berliner. Roger said, and he gets it, we will have a dedicated funding source piece of legislation done by the end of the year.
That's what he said to me after his appearance on this show last week.
But politically speaking, COG versus sounds like the bureaucracy that it is, but I don't understand why there's not a concerted effort, and I don't mean meetings that go on endlessly, but some kind of concerted effort to get lobbying on Capitol Hill to teach and to educate the Republicans. I think some of them, their anti-government thing, I can understand that. Yep. But I see no aggressive political move. That's why I keep suggesting close down Metro during the inauguration in January and let Congress and the White House know, whoever there's going to be in the White House. I mean, close the Capitol South and the Federal Center Southwest Metro stations and say we can't run them.
Yep, gets everybody's attention.
Why not? It just seems to me there's nothing that says this. You keep saying it's a crisis, but we're not getting through to Congress. And until you hit them over the head with a baseball bat, they're not going to pay attention to you. They're going to look at you like all the members from around here, from Van Hollen to Barbara Comstock, and say, you guys got to do better.
Yeah, exactly.
Someone has even suggested privatizing the agency. Is there any traction for completely or partially privatizing?
There isn't, Kojo, for two reasons. Number one, Metro is a unique agency. It was set up by the three jurisdictions. There's no entity that can take over Metro. Privatizing, I mean, Metro loses $1 billion a year on the operating side and has an $18 billion capital shortfall. Who would take over such an organization, and what would you do with it? It's not a situation
where
the
private... Give it to the federal government. They seem to know how to do everything. They can tell you what tracks to fix. They can tell you what you're not doing. Let Secretary Fox do it. He's going to be out of office come January.
You can't have nothing for free. You know, Martin, I need a dedicated funding source. All the other systems in America have one. I need Congress to step in and do their fair share, because if they were a normal partner, they would do so.
Here is Michelle in Silver Spring, Maryland. Michelle, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I keep hearing about people complaining about the fact that they're closing down Metro to do maintenance. What do you want? A pothole? When you have a pothole in the road, people complain about the pothole. And then when they're getting it fixed, they complain about the fact that there's a lot more traffic because there's road maintenance. And I feel the same way about this. I mean, this is maintenance that has to be done. I mean, why are people complaining about it? They should be happy that we're not going to have fires and unplanned shutdowns of the Metro system because something goes wrong because it's not being maintained.
Well, I think, Michelle,
you're... Our fundamental rule of existence in Washington, never inconvenience me.
That's your actually
How does
say
that rational person get on the air?
No, really. Let me just say this because she brought something up so I can put this in perspective. Metro is 117 miles. Imagine a two-lane highway, a two-lane superhighway from Washington to Richmond. 117 miles, exactly. Okay? A two-lane highway. There's no other way to get to Richmond. And the road hasn't been worked on in 15 years. It's full of potholes. Guardrails are falling off. Everything's going wrong. Cars are banging into each other. And you want me to fix it. How would you do that? Which section would you close down? When you get off the highway, how do you get back on the highway? It gives you a little perspective. And half of that highway between here and Richmond is underground.
Well, Southwest DC Gene tweets, ask Jack Evans whether WMATA has consulted with other transit reps in L.A., Atlanta, Chicago, and San Francisco, how they handle maintenance on their two-track systems.
Yeah. There are a couple others have a two-track system, and they clearly have been able to shut it down. And, you know, in Chicago, they shut it down for 6 months and repaired the track and then reopened it again.
And what do you do? Because when the mayor was here a couple of weeks ago in other jurisdictions, we have got to have a gearing up for World War II.
Yes.
We've got to create, if only temporarily, we've got to create bus lanes. We've got to have rapid bus lanes for these places are closed down. We've got to have no parking areas. We've got to make sure that people can move. And I don't get any sense that there's this kind of gearing up, whether it's Montgomery County or whether for Van Ness to
The Friendship Heights.
Friendship Heights. I mean, that's a nightmare on the streets right now, that section. Who's going to say, all right, for the next 6 weeks or months, whatever it is, we're not going to have any parking or anything on these two roads because the traffic has got to come through.
Well, the good news is Leif Dormstrow, who is our DDOT director, is on the Metro board. And so he is keenly aware of what needs to be done, and they are organizing as to how this is going to all work.
And the region can do this. I mean, there was a good example of when the Pope came to town and literally everybody was like, do not drive to work that day. Please, if you can stay home, just stay home, work from home, do whatever you can. And it worked. I mean, there wasn't the usual, there wasn't the gridlock they predicted. People stayed home. Now, these are longer shutdowns. This is longer single tracking. But if enough people are saying the same thing and telling people, prepare ahead of time, talk to your employer, make sure they can accommodate you if you're going to be late or if you can work from home. But it's true. I don't think I've started, it hasn't even really sunk in here at work. I feel like we're still kind of thinking about it in the abstract, but I live in Brookland, and that stretch from Brookland down to Nome is going to be shut down for 23 days. Right. Now, thankfully, I can ride my bike most places, but still, I have to start thinking about how that's going to affect my commute, getting my kid to school, that sort of stuff. So, I mean, the whole region has to start considering
this. It can't just be a couple of buses parked outside Metro. No.
And it can't be, otherwise the whole thing will fall into chaos. But I keep stressing, Metro is all our system. This is all us. There's no such thing as Mr. Metro or some guy behind a curtain like in The Wizard of Oz. This is us. There's nobody in charge other than Paul. Then you have me and the board.
Very quick, can I ask you about the union? You've got a union contract. They got an 11% raise, a lot of which went to them paying part of their pensions. But you've got a huge Metro. The union itself says it will work with the Metro to have a cleaner, safer system. But you've already acknowledged you may have to pay more money. I saw some tweets. People were very upset. You said they have to make concessions to the union.
Well, no, they got the tweet wrong. I said the union may have to make concessions to Metro. So if I misstated it on the prior program, I did not mean that we have to make concessions to the union. What I was saying, the question that was raised by Bruce was, in the workplace rules, does Metro have the opportunity to reassign people who are running stations, et cetera? And if we don't, then those concessions would have to be part of any discussion.
So it's not a matter of financial money for the...
Well, the money is a big problem. I mean, right now, the Metro's budget's $1.8 billion a year, of which $1.2 billion are wages and benefits.
$8 billion. Ariel in Washington, D.C. has some thoughts on that issue. Yeah. Ariel, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Gojo. Yes. Actually, I have questions and a comment. I've used the Metro often, and I noticed that there are enormous inefficiencies, such as, you know, they're trying to save money on electricity, and the escalators are running 24/7, or pretty much the time that it's running. They put LED lights, and then the escalators take an enormous
amount. Where are you going with this, Ariel?
Actually, it's a question and a comment. I noticed enormous inefficiencies in that could be improved, and one example of that is in Chile, in South America. They had the government actually was in charge of delivering water, and they could not fix it. So what they did is they had a company come in, and they pretty much privatized utilized a company to run the personnel, and the improvements were enormous.
So you're talking about privatizing the human resources system, the personnel system for Metro?
Yes, Carter.
Is that possible, Jack Evans?
It's certainly possible, and those are things we have to take a look at. I think I don't want to get us off track in the sense that money saved in our $1.8 billion operating budget is somehow going to fix Metro. We are looking at astronomical numbers that need to be dedicated from a dedicated funding source and from Congress. And everything everybody suggests are good. Efficiencies are very important. But they don't get us any, even the labor contract. If we save $100 million on the labor contract, it's nothing compared to the numbers I'm dealing with. So I'm glad we can try and do all of that. But without the other fixes, Metro is just not going to get to where we need it to be.
The board, though, is, I think the Metro board is many people, I won't say I think this, although I do, people think it's a bureaucratic mess. You keep railing at them. We've got to do stuff. You got to get behind the general manager. And they still seem to be just kind of
I will say this about the board now. There are 11 out of 16 members are new. And so I think the board is very focused. It's a good board, and I'm pleased with the representation.
And the federal workers, the federal appointees.
We have three brand new ones that I just met on Thursday. So I'm going to be sitting down with them, talking to them. And the fourth one, Tony Costa from the GSA, is very good. He's been very helpful over the years. So I'm pleased with who we have on the board. I think we
is
got
there a
great
Republican
board.
Among
couple
them?
No, I don't know. That's a good question. A
couple of quick questions before you go. These disruptions over the next year have people asking whether fares should be reduced. What are the possibilities?
It's a great question, Coach. And let me just say, I will give my personal opinion. I want to say this, so I'm not representing the board or anybody else when I say this. The fare structure at Metro is ridiculous. It doesn't make any sense. If you're in New York City, it's a flat fare, $2.75 wherever you ride there. If you're in D.C., it starts at $2 or $1.75. If you're coming from Reston, it's like $5.90, and you have to park somewhere. We need a fare system that makes total sense. A flat fare would be great, but it all costs money. And the point that you're raising is a little off of that. Should we reduce fares now that we're not running rush hour service because we're closing down lines and everything? I am happy to do that, but think of what I'm doing now. If I reduce revenue, I have to get money from somewhere to balance the
advertising
budget.
Advertising and stations.
Well, with that, we've passed a rule that we can do that too, but that won't ramp up fast enough. The jurisdictions, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, are going to be on the hook next year for something like $40 million or more than they're paying this year.
Each.
Each. And so if I reduce fares, that 40 could be 50 or it could be 60. So talk to your local jurisdictions, talk to the governors, talk to the mayor and say, are you willing to pay this amount of money for me to reduce fares?
Finally, we got a tweet from Raynell Cooper, who's a producer on the show. I guess if Tom can bring up Seagraves, we can bring up Raynell. Ask Mr. Evans about his stance on paid leave in the District of Columbia. I guess that would be paid family leave.
The proposal for 16 weeks is not going to happen.
Switching entirely off of Metro to something else.
It's not going to happen.
The 16 weeks is not going to happen. The chairman, Phil Mendelson, is putting a lot of time and effort into this. He will be coming back with a bill. I don't know what it will be. It's unlikely to be 16 weeks. I think you're probably looking at more like 8 or something
it's
like that.
It's what the city does now for its workers.
Yeah, for its workers. But I don't know. I don't know the answer. Whatever it is, at the end of the day, we will all get behind something. But we have to wait for the chairman to give us something to get behind.
All right, can we ask one?
Bring in the next guest, please.
Because if we don't,
Mr. Evans will not leave. So please bring Mr. Orange into the room.
While he's on the way out, can I ask you about the skins? You know, the mayor, or the events DC, everybody's talking about maybe a stadium at the RFK for the skins would pay for it.
I go back to what I've always said.
Vincent Orange about that.
We want the Redskins Stadium at the RFK site where RFK currently sits. The city pays for the infrastructure. We already have estimates from when Vince Gray and I were looking at this. Clear the site. You build the stadium. You have the practice fields there. You have a hotel. You have
But you don't want the Verizon Center there.
No, yeah. Verizon Center stays where it is.
Can you get Dan's
The only other alternative for the Verizon Center is to put it where the FBI building is.
The answer
with a
to
whole
your
lot
question, Martin, is no.
I would say get Dan Snyder to kick in a billion for Metro. I mean, I think that's an even deal.
Well, how about the Trump Metro? We could call
there
it the Trump
go.
Metro.
Make Metro great again.
That's it. Bring in the next guest. Jack Evans is Metro's book chair.
You guys have got to pressure Congress.
He's a member of the D.C. Council. He's a Democrat representing Ward 2. Jack Evans, goodbye. Thank you very much for joining us.
I'll wait outside in case you need me.
Tom Sherwood, this is something you covered last week, a judge sentencing shadow campaign operative Vernon Hawkins to 6 months in prison today. You covered that case, Tom Sherwood. Talk about the sentence.
Vernon Hawkins was the field general for get out the vote workers, getting people to the polls, putting up signs and all types of things, and he helped run and coordinate and run the shadow campaign. He got 6 months. The prosecutors had said he pled guilty. A prosecutor said the 77-year-old Vernon Hawkins should get a year in jail. The judge said she had looked at his record and that he had led a pretty good life up until this time, and so she gave him 6 months. And I talked to Reverend Willie Wilson, his pastor, and Reverend Wilson said it wasn't the best sentence, it wasn't the worst sentence. I think people are happy he didn't get more. Those who know him, those who think the city's ethical lapses haven't been punished enough, thought he should have gotten more.
6 months sentence, do they indicate anything about where he has to serve that sentence?
Well, no, the judge, the lawyers can recommend where he can go. He is 77. There are some health issues. But that's what they do. That's why you don't go immediately to prison or to jail when you get sentenced. They have to have the exploration of where you'll go, the Bureau of Prisons and all of that gets involved, and then he will go. And he was given the right to turn himself in when the time comes.
Joining us in studio is Vincent Orange. He's an at-large member of the D.C. Council. He's running for re-election in the district's primary, which will be held June 14th. Thank you so much for joining us.
The judge in this case
said that she felt that Vernon Hawkins did not operate out of a need for profiting personally from this, that he did this out of loyalty. From what you know about Vernon Hawkins, would you say that was probably true?
Well, you know, I wasn't part of the proceedings, so I really can't say whether it was true or not. But what I know about him, I know he didn't profit from whatever took
there was
place.
No flash in his life. I mean,
I know about I know Vernon Hawkins, too, and I would suggest it probably was loyalty in his case, that it wasn't any
what he did.
Personal profit. Of course, it's what he did that he got.
Being a foot soldier and being an organizer and being a fixer and all those, and I say fixer and I don't mean in an illegal sense, but just doing things, that was his life. There are a lot of guys like that around.
Each year, the district does a homeless count. Those numbers came out this week. For the first time since the annual census began in 2001, homeless children and their parents outnumbered homeless single adults. What do you think is behind that jump, and what do you think needs to be done?
Well, it's unfortunate that 4,667 homeless children and their parents are now bigger than the single homeless adults of 3,683. And really what it does, it just really crystallizes the problem in the District of Columbia of the lack of affordable housing, the lack of us addressing those with mental illness and other disabilities, and the need for us to really close D.C. General and provide good affordable housing, good training, and connecting people to all the jobs that are being produced here in the nation's capital.
The mayor's plan is stuck in Congress, I mean, in the council. The chairman is essentially rewriting it, take a lot of the private profit out of it and put it on city land. If we have more homeless, do we need more than the 50 or so scattered site housing that the mayor is planning to do by 2018 to close D.C. General? Do we need more?
Well, I've been reading that that plan, as effective as it might be, may only cover like 25% of the homeless families now under city care.
It's like 50 apartments. Isn't it like 50?
It's 272 units, which right. It's just to replace D.C. General. It doesn't right. include the 1,000-some-odd folks that were in motels, both in the district and in right. Maryland. So it really is, I mean, it's touching upon a relatively small population, but the population in the most emblematic example of the problem, which was D.C. General.
So where's the political will to fix it? Where's the political will to fix it?
Well, first of all, let me say I applaud the mayor for having the courage to step out and put a plan on the table that we're all looking at right now. And I think through the process, we will come up with something that actually works. She's made it clear that this is the problem for all 8 wards, and all 8 wards should participate as we address this issue. It needs to be tweaked a little bit, but at the end of the day, we need to shut down D.C. General.
What needs to be tweaked, in your view?
Well, the finances of the deal.
$660 million.
I think $660 million needs to be examined. The chairman has not put anything on the table, so I can't say exactly how the chairman is going to approach this. But I will say that our common interest, our common goal, is to close D.C. General and provide a better quality of life for the individuals and families that are now housed at D.C. General.
The mayor's supporting you for reelection. What do you think she's done that she's not? What do you think she should do that she's not doing, even though she's supporting you for re-election? I know you don't want to sit here and criticize her, but should she be moving faster on something else?
Well, I think the mayor has provided a good, fresh start for the District of Columbia. We've put a lot of things in the rearview mirror. We're moving forward. We're addressing homeless issues. We're addressing the opportunity to get more young people involved in city government and housing and jobs. I'm very pleased that the mayor has funded my bill to create the profile of the unemployed, the 25,000 people in the District of Columbia, and then to train them and connect them to the jobs that are actually going to take place. I think the mayor has stepped up in the area of statehood, putting that on the table.
I was asking what she hadn't done.
What criticism do you have of her? We're trying to start a fight here. Yeah.
No, I'm not. No, I'm sorry.
Well, not a fight. No,
we have an interesting. The primary is not till June 14th. You've got two opponents, Robert White and David Garber. The mayor is supporting you. For a while there, everywhere she went, you were with her. I thought you had joined the administration.
Well, let me say this, Tom. The mayor supported my bill that passed the council unanimously. The minimum wage of $11.50 per hour. The mayor. She's for 15 now.
Are
and,
you?
And I will be the one with the gavel championing that bill.
And that's later. The hearing is later this month, right?
The hearing is on May 26th. But also, the mayor pushed forward with me on the living wage, which is now at $13.85 per hour.
So there's nothing you criticize Muriel Bowser for as mayor. I'm not looking for you to beat up on the mayor. I'm just wondering where are some things you think she needs to work harder and your relationship with her, you can get her to work harder on it.
Well,
I don't think there is anything.
I would say going forward, I'd like to see the mayor work with me to make the University of District of Columbia a tuition-free institution.
Excuse me a second. Hold on. Here is Alina.
Up to associate degrees.
Alina in Washington, D.C. wants to talk about that. Alina, put on your headphones.
That's Bernie Sanders.
You're on the air, Alina. Go ahead, please.
Hi, council member. I was wondering, I've heard you talk about making tuition at UDC free and for DC residents. Is that going to extend to adults looking for graduate degrees? And how soon do you think that could even possibly happen?
Well,
sounds like she's lining up.
First of all, what we're talking about is making the University of District of Columbia Community College tuition-free through a associate's degree, and that's what the President of the United States is calling for across this country. And so we want our young people to be able to go all the way through college and get that degree and graduate debt-free. And then they can invest in a bachelor's degree moving forward. So, you know, I think the time is now for us to move in that direction. I think it'll cost somewhere about $15 million. The fact that we have in excess of $2 billion in our rainy day fund means that these surpluses that we are going to enjoy, we can use those dollars to help in the areas of education, in the areas of affordable housing, in the areas of mental, you know, mental issues. So I think
how much of that would you spend? The people say if you start spending down the rainy day fund,
First of all, I did not say we're spending down the rainy day fund. What I'm saying is that we have $2 billion in our rainy day fund, and any additional dollars will be surpluses that we can utilize, because Wall Street has indicated that we need to have 60 days of working capital on hand. We're at that point. So that means that we now have to start looking at how are we going to utilize surpluses going forward, because we don't have to continue hoarding money.
It's going to be interesting to see, because the rest of your council colleagues, I'm sure, have ideas. I mean, I've heard even folks saying, well, school modernization, we know that at the end of the next campaign, which is going to end in 6 years, there'll still be a dozen some odd schools that would not have been modernized. Let's just take money out of the rainy day fund now and get it all done at once. So it seems like it'll be an interesting fight over who gets to use that money and what it's used for.
Well, I think the residents and the citizens of the District of Columbia should be able to dictate what that money is going to be used for.
Dictate?
Yes. I think right now the residents are calling for affordable housing. I've called for $1 billion of affordable housing to be built over the next 10 years. $100 million a year, and broken down in four categories: $25 million for the homeless, $25 million for seniors on fixed income, $25 million of affordable housing for those that have household incomes of $30,000 to $60,000, then the traditional 80% of the AMI.
And what I've actually learned in reporting some stories about affordable housing is that a billion over 10 years sounds like it is a big number. It's a lot of money, $100 million a year. But $100 million a year translates to roughly 1,000 units. And that's, it kind of gives you a sense of the gravity of the situation. Right. You're talking 1,000 units a year is 1,000 better than nothing. But still, you've got, you know, when they closed the waiting list for public housing that the D.C. Housing Authority ran, you're talking 30-plus thousand people were on that list. Yeah. So it gives you a sense of how severe the issue is.
The issue is very severe, and we should finish up the new communities. We were supposed to provide 1,645 affordable housing units located at Berry Farms, Northwest One, Lincoln Heights, and Park Martin. We have not fulfilled that obligation. So we're demanding, we're asking for affordable housing. The fact that you have all these homeless families with children that are now exceeding single adults who are homeless, the time is now to build affordable housing and connect folks to the jobs here in the nation's
capital.
But
you're politically, you're not talking about public housing in the traditional sense. You're talking about mixed market rate housing and new housing. Or are you talking about building new public housing?
No.
Or just for low-income people, period?
No. As I indicated, I gave you four categories, and the fact that we are going to be having surpluses that we can, you know, provide the debt service to get these affordable housing units built, and we can build it for certain categories. We need to make sure the workforce can stay in the District of Columbia.
Well, what about Museum Square right downtown? The low-income residents there are fighting like hell to keep their place to live, and the city hadn't stepped in. The city could buy that building and turn it into affordable homes right there, but the city's not using its authority to buy the building at a reasonable price.
Well, I would say that all those things should be on the table. However, we do have the new communities, which is here and now, 1,645 units that we can, you know, bring to fruition. That was the promise that was made when we created the plan, the Economic Resurgence of Washington, D.C., Citizens Plan for Prosperity. That plan dug us out of a $518 million deficit, got rid of the control board, returned all the powers to the mayor, and set us on track to be where we are today. But we did not finish new communities.
Let's talk politics. Your campaign released a poll earlier this week conducted by well-known pollster Ron Lester, showing you with a 39% lead. To what do you attribute that? Is that merely the advantage of incumbency or the kinds of endorsements you've been getting?
Who's
been endorsing you?
Well,
Mayor Bowser?
Well, first of all, I would say it's because of the record that we've been able to provide. We provide results that folks can count on: the minimum wage, the living wage, 5 days of sick leave pay, the fact that we have got legislation passed that protects pregnant women in the workplace, and the fact that we're saying where we're going in the future, UDC, tuition free. We're also talking about the Marion Barry Summer Youth Employment Program extended to 22 to 24-year-olds. We have made contact with 2,500 young people, bringing them into the equation. And once again, the CBE program.
The
Certified Business Enterprise.
The
Certified Business Enterprise program. We can say with certainty we will spend $635 million this year procuring goods and services for our local D.C. businesses. So the dollar circulates in the city, and we can hire more D.C. residents. The key for us right now is education, I believe. I believe that we have to emphasize and make sure that our third graders, upon entering the fourth grade, can read independently and they can add, subtract, multiply, and divide. They must be able to make the transition from elementary school to middle school.
How do you do
and
that?
Move forward.
I mean, how do you do this as a council member? That's a school system project. I mean, are you proposing there be mandatory reading classes? How do you do that? Make the third graders
read? Do you test third graders?
Yeah. No, not at all. Not at all. What I'm saying is that
how
we
does
have
a council member affect that?
Well, let me tell you. What I'm saying is there are 12,000 young people in early childhood education. And if we're starting with three-year-olds, we need to make sure that we assess the three-year-olds in terms of do you need eyeglasses, do you need a hearing aid, what's going on in your home, what did you learn as a three-year-old. Then you become a four-year-old, making sure that you're able to progress. And by the time you're in kindergarten, you can take the seat. And then you begin to learn how to read, learn how to add, subtract, multiply, and divide. Right now, we're hovering around 38% of our children that can make that transition from elementary school to middle school. I believe the problem is not the middle school, it's what we send to the middle school. And we have to send a young person to middle school that is prepared to make the transition from learning to read to reading to learn.
Mayor Gray was very big on early childhood education as a council member and council chairman and as mayor. Do you support him in the Ward 7 race, or do you support Yvette Alexander?
I support all the incumbents in this race.
You support Yvette Alexander?
I support all the incumbents in
this race. But there's only one incumbent in Ward 7. You can't say her name?
I support all the incumbents.
Is that Yvette Alexander?
She's an incumbent, right?
Can you say her name?
I support all the incumbents.
I'm not sure I want somebody to support who won't say my name.
I support Yvette Alexander, okay, Brandon Todd, LaRubi May, and who are the other
yourself
incumbents?
One of your opponents in the at-large race, Robert White, has been leveling accusations against you. He's saying enough is enough of pay to play. He's circulating a document that he says that you sent out to contractors asking for contributions.
Well, Mr. White is wrong. I did not send out a letter requesting contributions. Did contractors hold a fundraiser for me? Yes, they did. However, the same people that backed him when he ran as an independent, he's upset because they are not providing the contributions they've provided him in the past. Go to dc.gov, go to the Office of Campaign Finance, and you'll see all the contributions that he received from those same contractors, and he's just upset right now. He's a flip-flopper. He was an independent, now he's a Democrat. He was accepting those contributions, now he's not accepting the contributions because he can't get the contributions. But this is about a record of achievement. Once again, we're talking about records. What have you done? And I think I have a very good record, and it's a record I'm willing to put up against anyone that would like to talk about the record.
What about David Garber? David Garber says that you're part of the past, part of the problems, part of the old school, and that we need new, fresh blood on the council, meaning David Garber's blood.
Well, I will tell you that none of the people that I'm running against have more energy than me. I'm in great shape. I've lost 65 pounds. I have a great record, and I have a record of where we're going. They're not talking about making UDC tuition free. They're not talking about making access to Wi-Fi and internet access free. They're not talking about bringing our 2,522 24-year-olds into the fold and working with them. They're not talking about $1 billion of affordable housing.
No, don't go through that whole list that
you've put forward ideas about. One of the things we asked Jack Evans about, RFK Stadium. What do you think should be done there?
Well, I support Events DC and their approach. They just had a big presentation on three different proposals, and they're going through the process. One process would have the stadium, another process would have the Verizon Center, and the other one would just have a mixed-use component.
Which one do you like?
Now, what I would like is that I think we should have been in discussions with President Obama and get access to all 500 acres out there, including Langston Golf Course, RFK footprint.
For what purpose?
The purpose to benefit the citizens of the District of Columbia.
Do you want the stadium, you want the Skins to build the stadium as long as they build it?
If the Skins are going to put up the money and it's a project that works for the District of Columbia, then I'm
that's
all for it.
Langston housing? Golf Course is federal property?
Yes, it is. So is Rock Creek Park and East Potomac Park.
Yeah. So, but how about housing on the site? Because that's one thing. And I know they said, well, the lease doesn't allow it. But the fact is they have to go back to Congress at some point and renegotiate the lease, extend it. So why not actually go to Congress and say, we want to put housing, $100 million you're proposing. Why not put $100 million of housing on RFK?
Well, I support mixed-use development there as well. You can have a sports entertainment complex as well as affordable housing.
The people who live up there need to have their parklands and
absolutely, you could have
retail
that as well.
They can't be shorted because they're the ones who have to put up with if there any additional traffic up there.
That is absolutely correct. And if you look at the Olympic plan and how they was going to utilize that land, I think that was a great plan.
Well, some people think that was just a sneaky thing to do to get the Skins back to town.
Okay,
with
we only
no
have
hope
about,
of getting.
We only have about 1 minute left, so allow me to get Jeff in Silver Spring on. Jeff, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, hi, Kojo. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a longtime listener. I'm also calling because I have some questions about for the council member about the plans to address homelessness.
We have a minute left. Make it quick.
So in my experiences working with homelessness, oftentimes what is referred to as soft services, the actual support workers, isn't very much funded. So my question is, what are the long-term plans to hire supportive workers, social workers, to come in and teach some of the skills that are needed to really have long-term success in alleviating homelessness?
Well, that's absolutely
part of the mayor's plan.
You must have those wraparound services and those employees that can provide those services. And now we're talking about homeless again. I'm also pushing for the mobile shower buses as well as providing personal hygiene products to our homeless women as well. So we need to have all the wraparound services and provide educational and job opportunities as well.
Vincent Orange, he's an at-large member of the D.C. Council. He's running for re-election in the district's primary, which will be held June 14th. Thank you for joining us. Good luck to you.
Well, thank you so much. A service above self and providing results you can count on.
That's it for the show today, but remember we've got lots more for you online and in person. If you're looking ahead to plans for next week, there are three WAMU in your bookstore events coming up. Monday, former Kojo Show producer Brendan Sweeney will be at Politics and Prose with author Tom Vanderbilt. Tuesday and Wednesday, we'll be at Kramer Books, where senior transportation reporter Martin DeCaro and Ruth Tam, a producer on this show, will each be in conversation with authors. Head to WAMU.org/books for all the details. And remember while you're there that you can listen to this show on your schedule by streaming it online or through your favorite podcast app. However you listen, be sure to meet us back here Monday at noon as the district rolls out a $20 million program aiming to boost achievement of minority males, including the launch of an all-male college prep high school east of the Anacostia River. The ACLU says, not so fast. As a lawsuit looms, we consider the gender politics of education. That's all coming up Monday at noon. Until then, enjoy the weekend. Tom Sherwood, always a pleasure. Martin, thank you for joining us. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Namdi.
Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Angelisa Schrobsdorf, Taylor Burney, Ruth Tam, Elizabeth Weinstein, Avery Kleiman, and Raynell Cooper. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.
Thanks for listening to the Kojo Namdi Show. And if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at WAMU.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.